and welcome to She Thinks, a podcast where you're allowed to think for yourself. I'm your host, Beverly Hallberg, and on today's episode, we're highlighting the latest IWF policy focus entitled Rent Control, a Failed Solution to Housing Unaffordability. We're going to start looking at the data to discover how much rent prices have increased and why, and we're then going to consider the history of rent control and discuss how well-meaning policies have led to decreased quantity and quality and ultimately reward wealthy rental owners, all while discouraging disadvantaged groups. And joining us to talk about this is the author of the policy focus, Patrice Onwuka. Patrice Onwuka is the director of the Center for Economic Opportunity at IWF. She co-hosts WMAL's morning show, O'Connor and Company, the leading talk radio station in the DC area. And she also is a frequent guest on Fox News, Fox Business, and PBS programs. Finally, she hosts a column called The New Agenda for Black Women on Newsmax.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Patrice.
Thank you for having me, Beverly.
So again, the title of this policy focus is Rent Control, a Failed Solution to Housing Unaffordability. People can find it at IWF.org if they want to read the whole report. But let's just get into some of the basics. What we do know is that rent prices have hit historic highs. People are struggling to make ends meet. Can you first of all break down for us the data? How bad is it?
Well, thanks for having me. And the data is terrible. I mean, when we're looking at the consumer price index, which is how we're measuring inflation, generally housing costs, particularly rent, are driving one of the biggest drivers of inflation right now. Average rent prices have increased 8.9% since 1980. And, you know, overall, you're looking at an 18% year over year inflation rate when it comes to rent. What this means is that it is extremely expensive and rent is consuming more of a traditional renter's household budget. Typically, financial experts suggest that you should be spending no more than a third of your income on housing costs. Unfortunately, because rent is rising in a lot of metropolitan areas and a lot of specific parts of the country, it's rising to over 50% of people's budgets, which means that they're squeezing out other important expenses and trying to figure out how to make ends meet.
And there's also this other issue, which is when you have interest rates high right now, it makes buying a home less affordable if people want to enter the housing market. Are you finding that more and more people are having to stay in a rental situation due to the increase of the cost of houses and also the interest rates on top of that?
Oh, sure. So right now the housing market is frozen, and the Federal Reserve did that to try to calm or tamp down on inflation. That means, though, that people who should be selling their homes and maybe they're empty nesters and trading down, maybe moving to a new place, they're stuck in their homes because they want to enjoy those 3%, 4% or lower interest rates. Well, if they're not selling their homes, then first-time home buyers or even people who have their first home and want to move into their next home, their forever home, they can't move. But particularly, it's those first-time home buyers who are priced out of the market because of high interest rates, because of the high cost of housing in general, and the price housing price values have skyrocketed during the pandemic and afterwards. So everybody's kind of stuck in their place, and you have a lot of people who could be owning homes, but they're now renting. And obviously, if you have more people renting and fewer places to rent, that is also a mismatch in the marketplace, which drives up rental costs. And on the property owner side, who are the landlords and the landladies, they're seeing everything from maintenance costs, the insurance costs, homeowner association fees. I mean, everything there, every service related to maintaining your property that you're renting out is increasing. So that's in part driving some of the rental increased prices that we're seeing.
So you mentioned some of the factors there for this increase. How did the pandemic play a role, if any?
Well, I mean, the employment shortages that happened during the pandemic certainly drove up the prices for services, repairmen, people who can do lawnscaping, people, and then you move into the utilities. We're seeing increased utility costs related to fuel price increases. But even as gas prices and energy prices kind of scaled back, utilities have continued to remain high. So everything related to maintaining and upkeeping your property with fewer workers to provide those services, it makes those services more expensive. And so not surprisingly, you know, as a landlord, you're passing those costs on to, in some ways, to the rent that you're charging. So it's the pandemic has been a challenge, but some of these challenges persist, you know, existed before the pandemic even hit. And I think the pandemic just made them worse.
And so we see elected officials try to find some type of solution to this. They hear from their constituents. They know that it's burdensome. And of course, we haven't even talked about the cost to buy groceries right now, which paychecks just aren't going nearly as far, no matter if their wages have increased. Inflation has outpaced everything. So would you say that when rent control is mentioned, it usually is with good intent, even, and we'll get to this, it actually has a lot of negative consequences? Are people well-meaning when they put this policy forward?
I actually think they are. Beverly, you know, the idea of saying, okay, we can try and control some costs. And so one of the costs we're going to try and control is the housing cost. And so by either capping the percentage increase that a landlord can charge their renters, or cap or setting a limit on the total amount that can be charged for rent in a given area. Usually rent control, we call them rent management. They have lots of different terms for it, but this idea, it usually happens at state and local jurisdictional level, not necessarily federal level. But the idea is, well, let's see if we can at least control one cost. We can't deal with food, we can't deal with utilities, but maybe we can deal with housing prices. As you rightly said, though, it opens the doors for some unintended consequences.
Well, before we get to all of those consequences, let's first put a spotlight on some of the states that have rent control policies in place. There are 8 of them. What are some of the states? I'm assuming we could look at blue states that have instituted this, California, New York, for example. What have we learned from these states? How long have these policies been in place?
So rent control dates back decades, 70s, 80s, particularly California, the District of Columbia, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, and Oregon. Those are the 8 states that still have rent control or rent stabilization. The good thing is that rent control is pretty rare these days, and it's because they have failed so miserably over the years. Different cities and smaller jurisdictions will try and implement rent control as a way to, you know, protect against rate hikes for their low-income folks, maybe to ensure that neighborhoods and communities retain their character by keeping kind of the same generation, the same demographic makeups in those neighborhoods when, you know, things start to change and maybe different people move into the neighborhoods and increases the prices. But rent control is not the right solution. It actually does the opposite of expanding the supply of affordable housing. The reason why you could prices keep rising is because there's no equilibrium. There's no good mix of housing, enough housing to meet the supply, the demand that's out there. There are not enough rental units that are at affordable level to meet the supply of all the people who want those. And so what rent control does is it restricts the supply of affordable housing even more, because now you're telling me as a landlord or a landlady, and as, you know, full disclosure, I am a landlady, but you're telling me that I can't increase my prices, how much I'm charging to my renters every year or every 4 years or whenever they renew their lease, because you think that I shouldn't be making profit. Well, hold on. Like I said, I'm paying more insurance costs for the house. I'm paying more to maintain the grounds, to cut the lawn, to remove snow, to remove leaves. I'm paying more in the utility bills that I cover. I'm paying when I have to replace a roof or a water heater or an HVAC system, all of which I've done in the past year or two. Those are costs that I have to eat. And so the only reason why people go into business as landlords is because they see that there's an opportunity to use some of their property. Maybe they're living there, maybe they're renting out space or renting out the whole property, but they realize while the rent can more than cover the cost, the mortgage costs, the interest that you're paying on the mortgages and the insurance. And so there's a little bit of a profit motive, but rent control or rent stabilization will say, well, no, Patrice, you can't, we want to reduce the amount of property profit that you're making. by saying you can only charge so much or charge so many, so much as a percentage of an increase on your rent. Well, after a while, if it's more expensive for me to rent out my property, then all of a sudden I'm not going to rent that property after all. If I'm losing by renting out that property, and that's what happens with rent control. You start to see in a lot of these cities that implemented this in the 70s and 80s, homeowners removed their rental units from the market after rent control was implemented because it was a losing situation for them. So you had fewer apartments for rent. You also had less money available to keep up or maintain the properties. And so you actually started to see more dilapidated rental units. That's not a good outcome either. The last thing you want is to see that you have more units where things are falling apart or people are living in unsafe conditions. And then, you know, there are plenty of stories, Beverly, when you think of rent control, particularly in New York City, of upper middle class, wealthy individuals and families sitting on prime apartments for generations, passing it down from generation to generation. You know, you're a millionaire, you're an Afghani princess, and you're in a rent controlled apartment paying just a couple hundred bucks a month. That is exactly not what rent control, the intention behind rent control. And so, but unfortunately, we've seen these things happen, which is why we don't think that it's a good idea to start to re-implement it.
And I think New York City is just a classic case, and you gave that anecdote there. I think what's so fascinating about that, it's not that every rental option has some type of rent control on it. A lot of these are grandfathered in. Yeah. Can you explain just a little bit about New York's laws on that? And is that how other cities have done it as well? Or is New York just its own mess altogether on this?
New York is its own beast. You do see some consistent or consistent policy approaches in cities like Boston and like New York, where either it is, you know, just you cannot charge more than X number of dollars for rent, or maybe it's the rent increase itself. It's the sad part, though, is that, again, you're reducing the supply of available housing. You're opening up the opportunities for inequity. We talk about that word quite often, but it's unfair. It's unequal for a rent control unit to stay in a family generation after generation after generation. They're growing in wealth because all of the money they should be paying towards market rate rent, they're keeping in their pockets, and they're able to pass down that unit for another family member. Meanwhile, you have a new family, maybe immigrants, maybe people who are just starting out in life, a young professional who can't afford the apartment, the market rent. They should be able, ideally, to take advantage of rent control. They're locked out of it because the lists are long, and there's no incentive for you to move off of the rent control if you have access to it.
Well, you talk about the discouragement to landlords like yourself who maybe just have one unit in the basement or something like that. What about developers? Do you see that there is a decrease in development in cities that have rent control? Because we're talking about the incentives here. There's no incentive for a development if you're not going to make a profit, correct?
That's exactly right. And so that's also one of the unintended consequences, all detailed in our rent control policy focus. But yeah, there's no incentive for developers to develop in a particular area if they know rent control, if they're not going to be able to recoup a lot of their investment on rent control properties. So you saw that unintended consequence. You also saw that the neighborhoods themselves, I think there's this idea that, local governments want to maintain the character of these neighborhoods by keeping them rent controlled. Well, that doesn't necessarily happen. That is not necessarily the case. And so, you know, when rent control has been implemented, certain people benefit and a lot more people don't get to benefit. And so quality reduces, quantity reduces, and then you have all these other negative spillover effects in the different neighborhoods.
So this, of course, leads to the question, which is, what do we do? And that's what's so great about our policy focuses at IWF is that there are solutions. What are the solutions to high rent prices?
Well, the big key is really about land use regulations. So it is, what can you build? What can you do with your property that you own? For example, granny flats, basement apartments, you know, converting an unused garage or, you know, a space in your, maybe some spaces in your own house, being able to change, local policymakers need to change the zoning regulations and the land use regulations around what can happen on a single part of parcel of land where there's usually a one family home, what can be done with that. Believe it or not, California is actually the leader in reform in this area, where in 2016, 2017, or 2018, they changed some of their zoning regulations and actually made it easier for people to create what we call additional development or ADUs, additional use apartments. It's the acronym is escapes me in this moment, but the idea of, you know, an extra space in your home, maybe it's a basement apartment, converting these spaces into rental units that property owners own and maintain and manage. But that's a regulatory change that has to happen. And part of that is making sure that you're removing some of the costs that's involved in converting your properties into these ADUs. Part of it is ensuring that the process, the permitting process, is not long and arduous and, you know, so confusing that it's even hard for someone to get into it. And we love this idea in particular for women, for older women, women maybe who have inherited their property, maybe their spouse has passed on, they have a big home, a big property, maybe they have a big garage and there's space over the garage, maybe there's an unused cottage, or, you know, maybe they want to build a little one bedroom house or an efficiency on their property. Well, states like California, and I think some localities are starting to say, we need to relax these restrictions, because if we do that and make the permitting process easier, now all of a sudden people are not creating illegal units. The government knows about them. They can be brought up to code. And in some cities like Boston, for example, they're even creating grant programs and loan programs so that you can convert your unused basement into a basement apartment. That hits a lot of goals. It helps to ensure that the homeowner can generate some new income. It adds to the supply of apartments and affordable housing in the neighborhood. And really kind of it reduces the price, obviously, of rental units in the area, the more of these types of apartments that you have going on. So if we are attacking and reforming the regulatory and the zoning rules and the land use rules, I think you're going to start to see an expansion in housing supply, and that's going to drive down prices.
And one of the things I've thought about as well, because I was a landlord in Washington, D.C., fortunately had a great renter, but there was a fear that I had going into it, because I know that the laws favor renters more than owners in that city. And I know a lot of other cities are like that. Is that also an aspect of this as well, where, of course, you want to make sure somebody who is renting has basic rights, isn't just thrown out without significant amount of time? But is this something where we want, being somebody who's an owner who wants to rent this out, that they have safety in this as well?
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the reason why California really wanted to bring what I believe over a million illegal ADUs, or these additional units, out of the dark shadows and into the light, so that they number one, the city and the state understood where these units are, but also that they could ensure that through a more relaxed permitting process that doesn't sacrifice safety, by the way, but removes a lot of the unnecessary hurdles, that they know that these units are actually brought up to code. So whether it's around fire, whether they're making sure that they have smoke detectors, sprinklers if needed, maybe if it's around the plumbing or the electricity, so that you don't have these kind of makeshift electricity situations that can easily become a deadly fire situation. So absolutely. I mean, there's room for rights for the renters, but also respecting the rights that property owners and landlords have in creating those incentives for them to want to lease out their spaces. You know, one policy that we talked about that's not a good idea, you know, just throwing more money at a quote unquote affordable housing and subsidies. We actually have a ton of money, and a lot of federal programs and state programs exist for housing vouchers and all of this stuff. That's not really going to get at the affordable housing issue. The real way to attack affordable housing in this country is to expand supply. And so I think, as from a financial perspective, the economy starts to thaw out and interest rates come down, people feel more comfortable to start moving, selling their properties. those first-time home buyers, maybe they can come back into the market. Suddenly you have more opportunities available for people to buy. And then at the same time, you're reforming the zoning laws, reforming the permitting processes, and making it easier for someone to create brand new rental units in their home on their property in a way that's safe and secure.
I think the moral of the story is, instead of increasing more regulation, throwing more money at the problem, it's actually about rolling back the red tape and let people have different options and think about ways to make a profit, which will then increase, of course, the quantity, but also the quality of the housing options available. It's a really important policy focus. Again, it's called Rent Control, a Failed Solution to Housing Unaffordability. Patrice Onwuka, always a pleasure to have you on She Thinks.
Thank you. It's so great to be on.
And thank you all for joining us. IWF does want you to know that we rely on the generosity of supporters like you. An investment in IWF fuels our efforts to enhance freedom, opportunity, and well-being for all Americans. So please consider making a small donation by visiting IWF.org/donate. That is IWF.org/donate. Last, if you enjoyed this episode of She Thinks, do leave us a rating or a review. It does help. And we'd love it if you shared this episode so your friends can know where they can find more She Thinks. From all of us here at IWF, thanks for watching.